My name is Eric Donaldson, and right now I'm inviting you to tune in to CKUT 90.3 FM on your dial. Oh, Eric Donaldson says so. Sing, tune in.
Against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT's annual funding drive runs Thursday, March 18th to Sunday, March 28th. Our programmers have been working hard at home all year, and it's time to celebrate their efforts. The theme of our first ever online drive is sowing the seeds of grassroots change, and we're asking you to support independent community media. Help us reach our goal of $25,000. Go to ckut.ca to donate today.
Sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds, sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds of change.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised. Are you a queer artist or activist in the Montreal area who wants a platform to discuss your work? Interested in producing radio for QueerCore on CKUT? Send an email to queercoreradio@ckut.ca. That's queercoreradio@ckut.ca.
Stay away from other people. Stay home and don't go out. Stay away from
that
other
means
people.
Stay alone. As
stay
much
home
as possible.
And don't go out.
Stay away from other
that
people.
That means stay alone.
Stay
as
home
much as possible.
Don't.
Why don't you keep your distance? Why don't you stay away? Why don't you be a stranger? Why don't you isolate? Why don't you come a little closer? Why don't you come and stay? Don't make me beg. Don't make me plead. Don't make me ask for more. Don't want to be ignored when I come knocking at your door. Please don't keep your distance. Say I'm the one you care for. Why don't you keep your distance? Why don't you stay away? Why don't you be a stranger? Why don't you isolate? Why don't you come a little closer? Why don't you come and stay? Don't make me beg, don't make me plead, don't make me ask for more. Don't let me ignore when I come knocking at your door. Please don't keep your distance. Say I'm the one you care for. Don't make me beg, don't make me plead, don't make me ask for more. When I come knocking.
6:06 p.m. and you're listening to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on the island of Jajage. We're just listening to Social Distance by E.T., fronted by my friend E. out of Minneapolis, and Slow Leak by The Violent Thing from Asheville, North Carolina. And my friend Scott plays guitar in that band. Scott and E and I are actually going to be presenting virtually in Asheville this upcoming Saturday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time at the UNC Asheville Queer Studies Conference. Our workshop is called No Blank Slates, a discussion of utopia, queer identity, and settler colonialism. The conference is free, and you can find out more about registration by going to the Instagram account UNCAQSC. So, it's kind of a special Queer Core today. CKUT is having our annual funding drive, and as some of you may be aware, last year's drive was canceled because it coincided with the first week of the pandemic. We've lowered our goal this year pretty significantly from $50,000 to $25,000, but we are recycling the theme that we did not get to use last year, which is sowing the seeds of grassroots change. And that theme for us really is about investing in community radio. Radio that is, independent, corporate-free, and really just all about the grassroots. And we like to think that if we sow seeds today, who knows what they will grow into tomorrow. So first of all, I wanted to shout out to Queer Core's first donor, Lauren LaFramboise, who contributed $60 to CKUT's 2021 funding drive in the name of Queer Core. Lauren is an incredible activist, artist, historian, and friend. So thank you again, Lauren. You can match Lauren's donation by headed to ckut.ca to donate today. Today's show is going to be a bit of a retrospective where I'll be playing excerpts from shows of the past year. It's been quite a year for queers in Montreal and abroad. Some of our biggest sources of income, such as the service industry and sex work, the service industry had to shut down because of the pandemic. Queer art, activism, and partying moved online. And, queers were at risk for eviction and were on the front lines of rent strikes when governments shut down our places of employment without sufficient financial aid, particularly in the U.S. So it's been quite a year. But before we get to that, I just wanted to play a few words from some of our Queer Core listeners talking about why queercore is important to them.
I love listening to queercore on CKUT because so many people living different queer experiences share their lives and their work. Their conversations are about creating a new and better world for everyone to live in. And that's the theme of CKUT's funding drive this year, sowing the seeds of grassroots change. I also love that queercore invites collective participation in the running of the show. There's just nothing like queercore, certainly not on the FM dial, and it's hard to come by media that is local, radical, queer, and collective all at once. So that's why we need to support shows like queercore and CKUT 90.3 FM. So this year's funding drive is a perfect opportunity to do just that.
Look, I don't have anything against the queers. My neighbor is a queer, and we get along fine, I think. But this queercore needs to be stopped immediately. It's a menace to society, and now they're asking for funding? What's next? Designated crew sites next to playgrounds? Think of the children.
All right, let's kick off our clip show with something from just over a year ago, March 16, 2020, the last queercore that broadcast in the actual studios at CKUT. I actually had Scott and E on that show with me. They phoned in from Minneapolis and Asheville, respectively. I was also joined briefly by my friend Cyber, who sent in a recording. Keep in mind, this is at the time when we just thought that we were going to take a two-week break, come back, and then everything would be good. So, the beginning of our clip show. Stay safe, everyone. If you can donate to the funding drive, we would really appreciate it. If not, we appreciate you listening. Bye for now. All right, welcome back to Queercore on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal, Jajage. If everything is working, I should be joined by telephone by two very special guests, Scott in Asheville, North Carolina. Sorry, I also don't have to reveal where the two of you live.
That's fine.
That's fine.
Scott in Asheville and E in Minneapolis, Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
Okay. Yeah, so you're both friends and also collaborators with me, if we ever get our project moving forward in these scary end times. How are you?
That's my number one priority.
How are you both doing in your respective locales, Scott?
I'm pretty like holed up personally. I'm like high risk being immunocompromised, so for like the last few days, I haven't really left the house. And I teach, and then that's moved on to completely remotely. Although I like went to school last week and then taught remotely from my office because I was like, I probably shouldn't be doing this. And then, yeah, there's not like a lot of confirmed cases in my immediate area, but I'm part of some local like organizing for mutual aid stuff in preparing like infrastructure to get people what they need.
How about you, E?
Yeah, similarly. So I also teach at a school here, and we've moved all of the teaching to be remote. And I'm still trying to figure that out, what, like, online teaching looks like. So that's been kind of a stressor. I'm not immunocompromised, so I am not super high risk, but I also want to recognize that I can also be a carrier and not exhibit symptoms. So I've been trying to – first, I started social distancing last week, and as of a couple days ago, hearing that a few friends of mine that I've been in contact with were going to get tested and might be positive for COVID-19. I have chosen to now start to isolate more with the knowledge that I might have been exposed. I just want to be aware that, like, I could not show symptoms and still pass it on to other people. So I've been pretty much just stocked up on food and just, like, hanging out at my house with my dog. And, yeah, trying to figure out how to not be totally anxious and stressed and depressed in spite of all this.
Yeah, we actually today, I don't know if you heard earlier in the hour, but this is the last hour of radio to air live. I'm sitting in the studio, and after that, we're closing down the studio. We made the decision earlier today that, like, though, like, you know, it's not a gathering place for, like, 200 people, there's, like, the traffic of a community radio station, and yeah, so that is, things are wild here. We're trying to figure out how to broadcast remotely and get, you know, people are confused. And definitely, I think people's feelings are moving faster than, like, people are testing positive for the virus, it seems like. But also, I just wanted to, you both really enjoyed the song. I just wanted to shout out No Master, No Servant. That was Kingdom of Heaven. It's like an edit. It's like, They've just been recording. They just got together as a group, queer trans group, local in Montreal. And shout out to Misery and Monica and other folks in that band. And thank you for allowing me to play that song on Queercore this evening. And I'm glad you both like it. I hadn't heard it before,
it was so
too.
Good.
I wasn't sure what I was.
Yeah.
Yeah, so obviously the theme of this evening's episode is about, I guess, precarity of work, like lack of security in a lot of different ways, what the federal governing structures of these continents can and can't provide us. And the obvious is that a lot of queer people are just, like, in precarious working situations always, whether it be that they're comedians, musicians, sex workers, working in bars and restaurants, touring musicians. And we don't know what the future looks like, you know, and there's no rent strikes. I mean, there's proposals for rent strikes, and there's, I think in Canada, actually, things are unsurprisingly moving in more optimistic directions. In you can go on employment insurance very quickly, so you no longer have to apply for it. You kind of just have to show, like, there's no waiting period basically. But you know, a lot of people don't work in sort of jobs where that's possible, so I guess I wanted to get both of your perspectives on how things are on the ground in the States, and yeah, just, like, what the future looks like for both, like, people in your positions, and also friend groups, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess I'll jump in because I just said yeah. My personal working situation right now is totally underemployed. I used to have, like, a full-time position at a university, and then the quote-unquote funding was cut, whatever that means. I think that it was a political decision. And so now I'm, like, teaching one course through a grant at a school. And they offer me a pretty good amount of money for an adjunct course. But part of that money was bundled into, like, travel reimbursement, which now I'm, like, I don't know if I'm going to get that because I'm forced to teach remotely, you know. And I'm supposed to, like, report all the time my travel, because the school is 2 hours away from where I live. And that was, like, a quarter of my pay. So, like, that isn't up in the air for me. But, like, the projects that I do for the most part can be remote. It's just none of them pay very well. So I'm, like, my precarity is, like, still, where it's at given this situation. But, like, the big thing in Asheville where I'm at, like, it's a tourist town with a lot of service workers, and that's, like, one of the main points of stress is, like, people in the service industry, like, suddenly not having work. I've heard that there's, like, maybe talk about, like it's like beneficial to fire employees so they can get unemployment insurance, and maybe there's, like, some setup things mm-hmm. too, but that's like a huge thing is people are trying to maybe like get together to see what they can do to support service workers if there's not going to be like, you know, if places have to close down, if they're mandated to close down. A lot of places are like takeout only now.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah. And like also, I mean, I'm imagining the tourism is going down also here. But yeah, so service work and then, you know, just like concern for houseless people and like protecting people who aren't like looked after, you know, in various ways. So like, you know, Firestorm Books, which is the local anarchist bookstore, also hosts a needle exchange program. They're going to be closing for the next few days just to like assess the situation, but they're like still going to be able to host the needle exchange program. They just like made an announcement about this. So that like that kind of thing doesn't go up. But then there's places that have free lunch and they're closing down because they can't, you know, promise to do that in a necessarily like low risk way.
Yeah, I've attended Food Not Bombs in Asheville and I can only imagine like what things are going to be like on the ground there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of houseless people, and, you know, there's like a lot of police looking for people to mess with. So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of organizing coming through this Beloved House. I'm not directly involved with that, so I can't speak too much. I'm sort of helping, since I'm in like isolation, I'm like helping coordinate drivers to pick up supplies and move them to other places. But we're trying to get protocol for doing that in a way that's like low risk of contamination and maybe having to quarantine supplies for a few days. But this is all like, everything's just like changing every like minute. And, you know,
right.
And we don't have like confirmed cases, but we're operating under the assumption that there's people here carrying it without knowing because their testing wasn't happening in Buncombe County where I live at all for a while. And since it's a tourist town, it's likely that people pass through. And we just heard that there was like someone who was here for 3 days and had it or whatever that means, you know?
Yeah. How about you, E?
Yeah, I kind of do a lot of things and all of them are sort of in flux. So one of the main things that takes up most of my time is being a student and a teacher at a school, a pretty major university. And so basically all in-person classes and in-person meetings and events have all been suspended for the rest of the semester. So it's kind of unclear, you know, they've said that like, you know, people are still going to get credit for the work they're doing and we're still going to be instructing and all that kind of stuff. But it's still sort of unclear, like I will still, you know, get paid as an instructor, but like what that work looks like, what I'm expected to do is just sort of pretty ill-defined. And then, yeah, what I'm expected to do as a student also, it just kind of feels like they're trying to, yeah, scramble to sort of, they're sort of making this up as they go along, which makes sense. Like a lot of this is, you know, changing really rapidly. But yeah, in terms of service work, I also, because I'm really inadequately paid as a student worker, I make below the poverty line. I also work in a cafe, a local, like, radical cafe. And, yeah, like, that work is always precarious anyway. That cafe is struggling. So, like, it's not really, like, that work is drying up. Most places, as Scott mentioned, Nashville, most places are working towards either closing, reducing hours, or maybe trying to work towards having, yeah, takeout only options and stuff like that. But basically that extra income won't be coming in for me. I know a lot of other friends where that's happening. You know, I have friends that work at a co-op, a grocery co-op that recently had a case. At least one worker was confirmed, if not more. And so that grocery co-op had to close while they sort of are like, I don't know what, decontaminating it or whatever that looks like. but it's sort of unclear like how long that store is going to be closed, how long those people are going to be out of work, whether or not they're going to get paid for like the work they were scheduled to do, let alone like the fact that they were, yeah, all exposed to this and what that even means for their own health and safety and the, you know, the health and safety of those around them. Yeah, and then also in terms of, like, the music that I make, I had three shows coming up with my band, and all three of those were canceled. And I don't know, just trying to think about, like, that as, like, this form of creative catharsis for me, and how to keep that going and how to keep sharing that has been something I've been thinking a lot about in terms of also, like, rethinking how we're social with each other, as we're sort of, a lot of us are sort of isolating more and seeing each other in person less and less. I'm trying to think about how to, like, also, be social, be creative, interact with people in ways that, like, we're not totally, totally isolating. We're not getting depressed, because isolation exacerbates depression, for a lot of us. And so, yeah, I've just been trying to think about, okay, if music is one of the ways in which I do keep myself, like, alive in a lot of ways and feed myself, both, like, literally and figuratively, then, like, how can I keep doing that, you know, beyond just, like, these show spaces that are falling through, too. So, yeah, I don't know. There's also been mutual aid networks set up here, particularly, like, amongst queer and trans folks. There's been a lot of, like, circulating of, like, resources and phone trees and things like that. So speaking to, like, what, you know, obviously, you know, governments can and can't do, I mean, I think this is really just showing that, you know, community support and mutual aid is, like, really what is going to keep people going in the face of, like, complete, you know, potential government shutdown, or, like, you know, like, inadequacy in responding to any of this. Like, obviously they can't care for us in the ways that we can care for each other.
Yeah, and in times where, like, globally we are being cut off from each other and, like, reducing ourselves to more, like, physical community, municipally sort of contained groups. Of course we have technology, but, like, what are the limits of technology? And I feel like all of that is being tested. So I'm as well thinking through mutual aid a lot. And okay, like, anarchist, like, radical folks, like, now is our time to really step up and, like, everything that we've been, like, working on and practicing in smaller groups, you know, this is like Katrina. This is, of course, and, like, what we talk about when we're working, collaborating, you know, the three of us, is, like, thinking through how apocalypse is also, you know, not just arriving right now, but people are kind of tuning into it right now.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Like, I was thinking about this, like, the networks I'm immediately involved with are taking this seriously and, like, trying to get stuff up and running to help people in need and make sure that, like, resource sharing goes to people in need, not just, like, from one, like, yuppie to another or whatever. And on the other hand, there's, like, other people who, and I could see this, like, response being, like, there's so much misinformation. Like, I don't trust the government. Like, I'm not going to take this seriously, and I'm just going to, like, do whatever and, like, travel cheaply. And, you know, so, like, I kind of understand that response, but, like, we have stuff in place here in the region, especially because we've been, like, near places, like, hit pretty bad by, like, environmental disasters. And so, like, there's already, this work has been going on for a number of years now. And so we can, like, kind of use those networks. And I'm just, like, hoping that there's a way, like, that this kind of pulls the veil up and people are like, oh, like, these structures we do better. And we need to, like, push it, like, a little bit more than just, like, oh, like, we can get food to each other easily. Like the, when you were talking about Kaya proposal for a rent strike, I'm like, this is like, yeah, this is like the time to do stuff like that. Like, this is the time where it becomes clear that, like, we don't need to pay rent. We don't need work in the way that it's, like, defined now. Like, these are things that are structures that are made to, like, hold us in place. And, like, you know, in a different way than, like, a quarantine holds us in place.
Yeah, but we need to turn in sort of and, like, focus on, I think, what E was talking about, like, those creative sort of, like, how we understand our, like, creative outlets and how that's feeding us, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, right. And it's also, like, limiting our ability to actually mobilize things.
We could talk for a while. I wanted to get in one last little clip that a friend had sent me. Thank you both for coming on, and I want to invite you back for maybe, like, a fuller episode when we're all kind of maybe, I don't want to say more settled, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. That'd be cool. I'd love to.
Great.
Take care.
Yeah, and we'll be in touch. Yeah. And thank you so much.
Yeah. Be safe, everyone.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye.
So my next guest is Sasha, and Sasha's in their mid-20s and has been a full-service sex worker for about 2 years, and we're going to just go play their interview live. Thanks for listening.
Hello, my name is Sasha, and I have been working as a stripper for over 2 years. So, during these crucial times, things have been looking down on us dancers offering our services and time for people. At this time, after what we call dead season, the time after the holidays, there has been a vast crash in the industry and clients are in need to save money, stay at home, and even avoid the cold. I continued to work, and so did many dancers, and work harder than ever, realizing it's not easy for everyone. That us dancers are indestructible, but in need of support and care at this time. February got better. Dancers, including myself, started going on vacation, treating ourselves because our work has a high demand in emotional labor, care, and holding space for others. Winter and the combination of this has been challenging. So I want to paint a picture of my world as a dancer. So my world as a dancer is someone who has many regulars, who wants to keep them all safe, who deeply is concerned for their health and well-being, who gets so excited to see them and really continues having a relationship with the people that I see often, and I hold space for them. They're very important to me, and I respect them so much. I came back from a week in Mexico in March, and there were a lot of new dancers. I noticed spring coming and changes at work, which actually excites me. I celebrate change. But this change brought up other new things to think about. So the club I work at is one of the oldest buildings in Montreal. It is timeless. It is historic. However, this concerned me. The place doesn't get a solid cleaning often, and even I volunteer to do so before my shift. So the vast change started this week, but in the news, in the pandemic, everything came up very fast this week. I was walking to work casually and then it hit me. Close proximity is not what is needed right now for anyone. Two dancers wrote to me before my shift saying they'll voluntarily take time off. Some of us absolutely need to work, so I understood the decision of coming in anyway and being present during this time. I came into my shift with my anxiety. I shared my concern about the possible spread. I felt this wasn't taken with complete seriousness. There were many girls working and laughing about the pandemic and started feeling maybe I was maybe too worried. I realized I also do this laughing reaction to things. If I am concerned or I am anxious, I do laugh it off and make jokes. And this day didn't feel right for that. I realized my influence of my own feelings was being surrounded by a laugh-it-off energy. I began to notice it. I did this shift and knew in my heart, even if this place didn't close now, I can take the precaution and make sure I'm not harming anyone else. I needed to take my own precautions because no one else will do this for me. So during my shift, I was careful. Even in my body, it didn't feel good to be in this environment. I did my best. This being my last day until further noticed. So what did this look like? Asking before I dance with someone if they can wash their hands, myself included, in between clients, I would go downstairs and clean up. But was this enough? We are in such close quarters with our clients that it started worrying me. And the realization as clients that do not take precautions and are disrespectful also made me incredibly sad. As a young, healthy person, whatever that means, air quotes, it is easy to come into work and be confident, but that wasn't right. Young and healthy? Do I know I am young and healthy? This is a timeless club where there are a lot of elders that come regularly with poor health. We don't know. And I saw them come in and say they weren't scared of anything, and that made me upset too. in times like these, our own feelings matter, of course, but the spread is what should be our deepest concern. If it doesn't matter to you and you're in close proximity with someone else, how can you project this onto someone else? The club was full this weekend of March 13th, and that especially made me feel uncomfortable. People saying, life goes on. I didn't feel like this was fair. And the club did close down yesterday, so March 15th, because they had to. And I feel maybe life would have kept going on for 2 weeks if they didn't have to. I believe the shutdown can allow people to think about the vulnerable and can have a positive outlet. I've been reading a lot about precautions versus paranoia, and I felt the crash after dead season, these precautions is more important than making money. I've been emailing my regulars that I care about deeply to take care of themselves. I want to see them when this calms down, stronger than ever. I want to see everyone healthy. I want to see dancers take time off, even if it is a crucial time. I want us to rest. After distancing myself from others' realities, there is a big struggle for a stripper taking time off. And why? Well, we are not registered here in Montreal. We do not get paid to take time off. This until further notice. We're not entitled for sick leave. If we do not work, we don't make anything. Even if we get an injury from work, we do not get anything from this. I want the public to think about this. I want everyone to be aware how vulnerable we are and how much we put out there. This evolving situation makes our stripper reality painfully clear. I love performing. I love dancing. I just want to demand for more care, more love. I was willing to ignore and hide the reality in the dark. I am thinking about it more than ever. I was just put into a stripper group chat where we can take care of ourselves. I want this. I celebrate this. Our sisterhood is there. I want the management to be there. I want them to think about this. I want them to check in as much as they can. I want them to clean. I want clients to take consideration of others. And if you're sick, stay home and take care of yourself. Even without this pandemic, this is extremely necessary. We as workers need to continue working. Again, no sick leave. No option to take time off. This is our independent work. Think about all the independent workers out there. I want this to come up for you. So during this self-isolation, I request we all take each other's situations very seriously and be there for one another. I see so many lovely Facebook groups where people in isolation, people delivering, caretaking. This makes me so happy. I feel so much gratitude for communities like this, and I want to see them growing. I encourage those that can support your local sex workers online. This is what you can do. If you're isolating during this time, please support your local sex workers online, whatever that looks like. Finding a way to tip without being in person, e-transfer, Cash App, etc. Purchasing content, custom videos, checking in and seeing if we are safe, okay, well. Please protect yourself. We are all important and deserve all these precautions. I want to see us coming out of these weeks stronger, in our 7-inch heels again, coming in as community and letting this be a regular thing where we strengthen our immunity and constantly strengthen that immunity while we are working and those who we are close with. Think about each other. I think this can bring a very positive outlet to us. Let this be our way of being careful always. Checking in always, checking in with ourselves, reading our bodies and our abilities. It's okay not to be okay. And most importantly, I ask you to breathe. To breathe during this time. Thank you so much for hearing my story and the struggles that a stripper is dealing with during this time.
Finally, Estelle Davis joined us on June 29th to talk about the criminalization of sex workers throughout the pandemic, and I think this audio is a perfect way to end our clip show. Once again, please donate to CKUT if you can. Have a good day.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's true that COVID really, it really brings up that criminalization element, because yeah, like through the work that we do at Aztec as well. I mean, we're taking what we need to, but at Aztec specifically, like we were seeing, which is, you know, it's this trans sex worker project that I work for. When the coronavirus crisis hit, like we were just like, it was like people were coming to Aztec, like calling us constantly, like knocking on our doors, being like, what the hell like is happening? You know, like, what can we do? I have like sex workers just being like, we have no income. And just kind of like day after day, just in a state of like total shock, you know? And yeah, it really just made it so clear to me as well, like that dynamic, you know, like where you have CERB, which is, you know, you can consider it like it was made available to a lot of people, but it's like the kind of underclass of Canadian society just like did not have any access to it. And that includes people who are already on welfare, you know? And I think that was one thing, because, you know, you had this whole class of people who could not access CERB at all because they don't file their taxes, they don't have a SIN number, you know, they didn't make enough money the year before or whatever. But then you have this other class of people who have been receiving welfare benefits, you know, which is around $600. And then the CERB comes out and says, like, oh, $2,000 a month is like what people need to live on. But then people on welfare are just receiving $600 a month, you know, and we know like what the welfare system actually does is it also criminalizes people because it forces them to engage in illegal activity, right? To like illegally working, illegally making some kind of extra money to like survive, because the $600 is not something that anyone can live on.
Yeah, and because of the like the surveillance within your bank account, you know, they're watching for anything coming in,
yeah, being exactly
deposited. So like, exactly, of course, yeah, you have to do stuff under the table.
And a lot of sex workers are on welfare, you know, because some people use sex work to supplement welfare because it's not livable. So then, and you know, like, I don't know, there's this kind of, I don't know if it's widely thought this way, maybe it's not, but you know, there is the idea that like sex workers can make so much money or whatever, but the fact is most sex workers are poor, and like welfare becomes livable if you're doing sex work, you know, if you're able to like find some other means to make a bit of money to like meet your basic economic needs. And so when CERB hit, or like when coronavirus hit and sex work wasn't possible anymore, and like really wasn't for a lot of people, like it just really wasn't, like, you know, especially like street-based sex work was just not possible. Like having clients over to your house became a lot harder because there was so much surveillance happening. Yeah, so like losing that extra part of your income is just devastating, you know?
Definitely. You kind of mentioned an increase, or you did mention an increase in demand that Taking What We Need was receiving, and also Aztec, where you work, people were coming and, you know, asking for help. Have Aztec and Taking What We Need been able to adapt, or has it still been quite a struggle to meet the needs of, you know, the amount of requests you're getting?
No, we've actually been able to, adapt quite well. Yeah. Like, at Aztec, basically what we did is we put in place like this service counter, like right away. At first we were doing it 3 times a week for maybe about the first month. And then we went down to 2 times a week where we had amassed like a certain amount of, like we have an emergency fund at Aztec, but then we also just started applying for, I don't know, emergency money from, you know, from city councilors or from MPs or whatever, like just being like, we need money. And there was some money available at the time. So we got some money in, and basically what we did is we just created this program where we're there at the service counter. We bought tons of gift cards, and we also just had cash. And so people would just come to the service counter and we would just give out, you know, whatever people needed, we would just give to them. And, we, you know, we weren't able to give like a ton, like we couldn't pay someone's rent, but, you know, we were giving out $100 per person per time when they would come in, kind of thing, which is at least something. And and then with taking what we need as well, what we did is we just basically were like, okay, it's the, you know, it's the era of the online fundraiser. So we basically just put all our efforts into that and, you know, just launched a campaign. And yeah, we were able to make a significant amount of money, enough to respond to the requests that were coming in. And then more recently with protests against the murder of George Floyd and stuff, when we adapt, like when we started to prioritize Black and Indigenous, trans and two-spirit people, you know, we were already seeing like a lot of money being moved around because of the massive power of that movement. And so when we started to prioritize Black and Indigenous, trans and two-spirit people, we were able to raise some more money as well. And so, yeah, we're able to meet the demand as it stands right now, which is awesome. Yeah. So it's been cool. It's been really, I don't know. I don't know what to say. Like, it's not, you know, like it's not the biggest thing in the world. Like it's just a little bit of money, but I think on, you know, on some level, like it can really help out.
So you were involved in a panel discussion that happened over a month ago. I think it was a month and a half ago. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was about policing the pandemic. I think it was started by Alex McClelland.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Alex, and I think it was by Alex and then Alex's friend, Alex.
Okay. Alex and Alex. Mm-hmm. And Alex was drawing attention to, I guess, how policing has increased during the pandemic, and specifically how certain populations who have been historically policed, over-policed, are, like, continue to be the ones that are going to be affected the most by the, you know, racist, colonial, transphobic structure of the police.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about what your sort of section was on.
Yeah, well, I wanted to bring like a really Montreal specific context to the discussion. And so, and I think that Aztec, I've learned so much from working at Aztec, and I've, you know, I've been there like 6 years, and there's, you know, Aztec, the city of Montreal really like has this really rich, sex worker history, and specifically like trans sex worker history as well, but it's hard to find, you know, like it's hard to find in general, but I think working at Aztec, like I had, you have a really, because Aztec comes from, like it was started in 1998, so it's been around for 22 years, and it was started by trans sex workers, you know, who were working in the red light district at the time, and who were, you know, fighting back against all kinds of things like gentrification and over-policing of the village and the HIV crisis and transphobia, of course. But also, you know, like immigration laws and anti-sex work sort of policies in the city. So Aztec has this, I don't know, that you just, I have access to this kind of really beautiful history there. So I really wanted to bring that to the conversation. And one thing that started me, like when I was seeing, because I was following Alex's project for a bit, and the thing that struck me the most, the connections between the work that other people were doing with the policing the pandemic discussion and what was happening at Aztec was, you know, Aztec has always been really present on the stroll, like the sex worker stroll in Montreal, like the trans sex worker stroll, which is historically, wasn't always on Ontario Street, but like for the past 20 years or so, it's been, the stroll has been on Ontario, just north of the gay village. And so we've, you know, our outreach workers like always work there. People who work at Aztec have also worked on the stroll, you know, so we have this like connection to it. But in the past sort of 8 years or so, seven or eight years, like the stroll has really, like it used to be really vibrant. And I think it's slowly diminished. Like there's less and less girls working there. You know, it became sort of over-policed. The gentrification, like around the Ontario Strip, really pushed a lot of people out. But also there was this bar, this really vital sex worker bar called City Bar that was open just at Ontario and Papineau. And it really contributed a lot to the stroll being this really vital place for trans people, like trans sex workers to work, but also to live, to like meet other girls, to like, I don't know, learn how to transition together, to organize as well. But yeah, in the past couple years, it's, you know, slowly kind of been on the decline. But then what happened with the coronavirus, which I thought was really, you know, really scary and sad, is like the stroll was actually fully closed for the first time, you know, since it has been in operation. So like we knew, like starting around whatever the first or second week of March 2020, like the stroll was officially dead because there's cops all over the village, you know, so you know no one's working there. People are scared to go outside, you know, like everyone, like the kind of the paranoia about the virus was really, really high. And so, and, you know, sex workers didn't want to be working as well. But anyways, the stroll was closed. And so I thought that was, I don't know, I just thought it was really unprecedented. And it's directly related to policing, right? Because what happened with the coronavirus crisis is like just the Canadian state's response was policing. Like that's how they're going to deal with the public health crisis, was to like rely really heavily on the state. And we were considered like essential workers at Aztec. So I worked through the whole crisis, and I would walk to work and, you know, be in the village. And it's just like, there was every, like the streets were dead empty, you know, besides like the communities that actually like live on the streets, like the homeless populations downtown. So it was just the people who were living on the streets, and then just cops everywhere. Like every second car or third car you'd see would be a cop car, you know? And so I don't know, it just really made me think like what is happening to these workers, you know, these people who relied on the stroll every night to make money, to pay their rent, to eat. And we really didn't know, like, you know, we have like good contact with some people who worked on the stroll, but like not everyone, you know? So it's like, I don't know. We didn't know, and we still don't really know like what happened, like if it got moved, like where all those workers went, how they ended up surviving, if they did, you know. And it's still not open now. Like it's still closed now. And even though I think some of the parameters around coronavirus have changed, you know, like we know some of the restrictions are being lifted, but the stroll is still not functioning like as a work site. And so it's kind of devastating. And there, you know, there are certain classes of sex workers, you know, this who are already like tapped into things like the internet and could make that kind of, you know, could use those like different work sites, like online or whatever, to like make ends meet. But I feel like it's going to take a couple years really to really figure out like what happened to trans sex worker communities in Montreal during the coronavirus, like when the stroll shut down, you know, like what are the impacts of that? And then like, what are going to be the impacts of that over the long term? Like, will it open back up, and will it still be in the same place? Will it even be viable, you know? And I think it's all directly related to policing, really. Like, it's the police that shut it down. Yeah. I don't know. That's sort of what was on my mind when I was thinking about that conference.
Yeah, and I think, like what you said, when these sort of violent displacements happen, it's really hard. Like, they are so... Displacements are a violence in such a way that it's hard to rebuild what was there, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because usually it's like people come in and they set up new sort of mechanisms so that, like, mm-hmm. once the bodies are actually out, and I don't want to refer to people as bodies, but, like, I know that the state views people as bodies. Once the people are actually physically displaced, then there's, like, no stopping, like, the violence of the gentrification that is, like, seeking, like, it's using COVID. It's using these opportune moments when people are inside and the eyes aren't on the street to kind of move in and enact, like, what it has wanted to enact for a while.
Yeah, exactly. I think you put it so well. Yeah.
And, you know, like, I'm from Vancouver. The same story happened in Vancouver in over different years. And you've probably seen Hookers on Davie. And you know the story that, you know, there was a big push by West End, predominantly white gay men in the Vancouver West End neighborhood to push the trans sex workers and the male street hustlers further out of their neighborhood. And, you know, the sex work strolls in Vancouver have gone further and further out, and some of them have disappeared altogether. So COVID is just another, like, when we talk about the gentrification of sex work, a lot of us think about the gentrification of the physical neighborhoods, and I guess the gentrification that the internet has kind of had on street-based sex work. But I think for a long time we're going to be trying to figure out the damage that, you know, COVID had on street-based sex work communities.
Yeah, exactly. And just like the, I mean, I guess it's really, at the same time, you think that, I mean, you know, my main question probably would be like, okay, there's this increased police presence, and then the dynamic is likely going to be that that police presence, that increased police presence is now justified, right? And like, can continue into the future. Like, even when Corona potentially, like, let's say Corona, you know, a vaccine or whatever comes out, and we sort of, there's some, you know, the capitalist system is able to somehow, like, subdue Corona or whatever. But then maybe we continue to see this increased police presence, right, in certain communities. But then now we have this, like, global movement challenging the police, really, you know, and you have calls for abolition, and you have calls for defunding, right, that are receiving sort of like national and international attention. So it really makes me, I don't know, I'm wondering, like, what is going to come of that. And I know those two things are related, right? Like, I know that, I think that the uprising is linked to this crisis, right? Like, the coronavirus crisis. I know that there, even in Montreal, like, we're seeing more specific calls, right? Like, people are talking specifically about defunding the SPVM. And I know there's coalitions forming at the moment, right? And there's demands being written up. And so I'm wondering, I'm personally really hoping to be part of that, that movement. And hopefully we can get some leverage to really fight back against that tendency to, you know, try to justify this increased
time. feet. C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Cam.
C. Wait.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy. The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance. We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. We've got a special interview today with Mar from the musical project For Esme. But before we share this interview, it is the CKUT funding drive, and we want to take a look back at Dragon Root and CKUT over the years. My name is Hannah. I've been hosting Dragon Root on and off since 2011, along with several other collective members. I started at CKUT in my undergrad at McGill. I was a super shy kid, but wanting to be part of a community, and I heard about a collective member call out for what was then a new show starting on the Tuesday morning after called Dragon Root. Now, originally, I just wanted to help out behind the scenes, but to my surprise, I wound up behind the mic hosting a feminist radio.